Hello and welcome to today's City Club of Boise program about how arts, culture, and history organizations in Idaho are working to confront the legacy of racism. I'm Greg Hahn. I'm a member of the City Club's board of directors, and I'm today's moderator. First, I want to welcome our radio listeners. They'll be joining us at a later date on Boise State Public Radio, KBSX 91.5, and all of its affiliates throughout Southern Idaho and Northern Nevada. I'm going to get in trouble for saying Nevada. Today's forum is available for our audience in large part because of our City Club partners and sponsors. I want to take the time to thank a few of these organizations to help us achieve our mission to ensure a compelling conversation, engage citizens in a dynamic community. Our premier sponsor is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU College of Business. Our annual sponsor is the University of Idaho. We also receive support from our forum series sponsors. That's AARP Idaho, the Bank of Idaho, Climatech Corporation, Echelon Group, Micron, Pacific Source Health Plans, Small Mine Development, and St. Luke's Health Systems. City Club of Boise receives grant funding from the Idaho Humanities Council, which is we're very appreciative of. We want to thank our media partners, along with Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, the Idaho Statesman, Idaho Public Television, and our university partners, Boise State University and NNU. Finally, I want to thank the members of the City Club of Boise, the individuals and organizations who understand that though the critical issues we face, the technology we use, and the people who even live in our city are ever changing, the need to come to find common ground, to listen, to seek shared solutions, and to learn from and respect each other is foundational to our experience of our community. So over the past few months here in Idaho, individual artists, staff members, leaders of organizations of all sizes started gathering on Zoom to confront the continued legacies that isolate, tokenize, and exclude Black creativity voices in art, and to explore how they, as mostly all white Idahoans, though not all, could do something beyond the lip service and the performative allyship, you know, that you might see on Instagram and Facebook and in live events that may serve to tamp down immediate tensions, does little to make the deep and systemic changes needed to make a real difference. These two guests today have been involved in these conversations from the start, and I'm really grateful that they're here to kind of talk about this more broadly. I do want to point out that I'm involved in the coalition as well through my new job as a director of Searle's Place. Our board, we're an artist residency, a nonprofit artist residency in Garden City, but our board and our organizational leaders before my time and now are deeply committed to this coalition and its goals. I'm a newcomer in the group, and I probably have a lot of the same questions that you will have, and I've had some aha moments that hopefully you will have as well. So I'll try to navigate this conversation with that in mind. So the two folks we have today are Lita Harris-Neustadter. She's an arts educator, a musician, an actor, licensed clinical social worker and a community organizer. She went to Occidental College in Boise State, and she owns an outfit called Metamorphosis Performing Arts Studio. And she maintains both a private counseling practice there and weaves life skills into music, acting, and public speaking lessons. She works with schools throughout the Treasure Valley and is a member of the Western States Arts Federation Emerging Leaders of Color Professional Development Program and a certified change leader through the Idaho Commission of the Arts. You've probably seen her. She's been performing in and around the Treasure Valley for over 30 years. John Michael Schert is, you may recognize if you're a fan of dance. He moved to Boise with the Trey McIntyre Project. He was co-founder and he was executive director. He was the business mind as well as the dancing talent in the Trey McIntyre Project. Now he runs JMS and Company. It's a consulting firm. It translates this creative process across disciplines. And he's been an executive producer at Treefort Music Fest. He's been a visiting artist and social entrepreneur at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. He was actually the first one to launch that program. He's an associate fellow at the NYU Center for the Ballet and the Arts and a 2019 USA Eisenhower Fellow. He earned a master's degree in public administration from Harvard University, John F. Kennedy School of Government. Thank you both very much for being here. John Michael, you drew the short straw, and we're hoping you can just give us an overview of how this coalition came together a few months ago.
Most certainly. Thank you all for having us. Thrilled to be with City Club again. It's been a little while since I've gotten to present to this fantastic community-oriented group. I see Laura Kendall is on the call. Laura Kendall is the Morrison Center Executive Director. I'm going to go back a little further before the beginning of the Anti-Racism Coalition, which was the pandemic hit in March. And Laura Kendall sent an email to myself and Eric Gilbert of Treefort and said, what can we do to help artists in our community? You know, what can we do immediately? And she was a huge catalyst in getting the City Department of Art and History, Treefort, and others to create the COVID Cultural Commissioning Fund. And so that was a separate project. We raised money. We got commissions into the hands of individual artists. But what it did, Laura's prompting, was it got the arts community talking in a way that I feel like we're not always doing. Sometimes institutions talk to institutions, sometimes actors talk to actors, dancers talk to dancers, but we don't come together as a whole community. And so the CCC Fund helped galvanize the greater, broader cultural community. That was March of last year. Fast forward to June, the murders of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery, the racial justice uprisings. These things happen in cycles. They happen in societal, civilization cycles. We haven't really seen this level of demand for racial equality in our nation in 75, 80 years, right? So again, Laura Kendall got us started and said, what can we do? We need to be having conversation. This is horrifying, this is tragic. And so we kind of used this community that we'd started to build through the CCC Fund and said, well, we need just to have conversation. And I was actually staying, Greg, in your cabin up in Atlanta, Idaho, when Laura Kendall reached out to me and said, we need to organize. And I immediately reached out to Lita, who I've known now for 13 years since I moved to town. And as you quoted in her bio, we all know Lita. We know the work she's been doing on the ground as all of the things she is, but also as a Black woman for some time to ask for Black liberation and racial justice and racial equity. So I reached out and I said, Lita, we have a predominantly white arts community that needs to have conversation around what does it mean to be anti-racist. And because of the master's degree I just received, my faculty advisor was Cornel West. And so I'd gotten a really sort of fantastic education on a lot of the history of racial justice in our nation, going back to its founding, back to early 1600s, and really looking at to discuss the problems of racism, we have to look backwards and understand the system that we sit in and then begin to prescribe where can we go forward. So the history of the Anti-Racism Coalition was really, as always, community members, citizens of the creative community coming together and saying, we have to have conversation. There was no prescribed outcome at first. And we immediately started just sending out an email to all the arts and cultural organizations, individual artists from the CCC Fund, and said, would you all be interested in coming together? The result was astounding. Hundreds of people began joining. We began having monthly conversations that Lita and I would facilitate. First, beginning with, what is racism? What is anti-racism? We began to use a document, sort of a scaffolded document, that walks people through the process of how you become more and more anti-racist. And this group began to swell. With that, a small working group formed, chaired by Lita, a Black-led group that was made up of Laura Kendall from the Morrison Center, Laura Reynolds from the Philharmonic, Aaron from the Botanical Gardens, a variety of arts and culture leaders, individual artists. And they met, Lita, 7, 8 times for hours to really craft, what do we want? What is the statement that we want to make as a coalition? And they worked very hard. They would run that by the larger group. They would go check against national colleagues. Because again, we say arts and culture, that's massive. That's a big bucket. And so we had the benefit of having someone from the Philharmonic Orchestra world in the room, someone from the theater world, someone from the ballet world, someone. So they would go check with their peers across the nation. And then we would come back together as a large community and say, what do we want to say at this moment? And that resulted in the membership, or there was no membership at the time, of this fledgling coalition coming together and saying, we want to say something as a community to the world in terms of what we believe, which is both naming the systemic issues of racism and white supremacy from the past, but also beginning to say, here are the 6 steps that we all commit to move forward. So with that, we ratified with about 60 plus members at the beginning, this our statement and action steps It was published in early September. There was some press around it, and we put that forward to the world. The reason for this is not just, as you said in your opening, Greg, to sort of virtue signal or act like, oh, look at us, we're saying and doing all the right things. It's really to hold each other accountable and to hold each other's organizations accountable, to say, what, this is not going to be easy. Most of these organizations are on this wide spectrum, which I think Lita will get into in a moment, of, is your organization upholding practices of casting, of hiring, of programming artistically, that's upholding systems that you don't even realize you're doing? So how do we begin to hold each other accountable in these action steps? And also to recognize that this is a massive process. It's not, you can't flip a switch and suddenly be anti-racist. We all have built into us, especially as a predominantly white community, all this programming and our internal programming around decisions we make, you know, ways we see the world, that is a bit painful to have, you know, to awaken and say, oh wow, I've lost of innocence. I have to realize that I have a lot to reckon with on an individual level, on a societal level, and with organizations. So the work of the beginning of the coalition that I'm proud that we did as a community, but it's ongoing, it's nowhere near done, is that every emissary within the coalition had to go back to their organizations and have very difficult conversations with their board of directors, with their staff, with their artists, and with some of their donors. And I can tell you, the backlash is real. Donors of major arts organizations threaten to pull funding if they sign this statement. People have reached out to sponsors of certain arts organizations and said, and said to the sponsor, you know, you need to pull your funding from this arts organization. I'm very proud of our community, because that's the work, to have very difficult conversations and to say, no, we choose to continue in spite of the potential backlash. But the real work is that it's not putting out a statement. The real work is having ongoing difficult conversations, especially with the people that we're most loyal to, or that are most loyal to us, like our patrons, like our board, like our artists and staff. So that got us to sort of the fall. And we've continued having monthly gatherings, a place for the community to come together. And I'll stop there before we talk more about what's next and what the coalition is going forward, because in many ways we don't know. But what it is now is about a 70 plus member group of organizations, institutions, artists. And we've expanded the idea of what is arts, culture, and history, because we included history as well, history organizations. Preservation Idaho is a member, you know. How do we want to move forward as an anti-racist community, and how do we hold each other accountable? That's been the work to date. It's been difficult, and even more so, I think, for BIPOC members like Lita in our community to also continue to show up in a predominantly white space and have difficult conversation. But we've chosen collectively that this is the work. And the last thing I'll say, and the six action steps, we won't illuminate them right now, but they are available and we can share them with the City Club membership and to radio listeners. Laura Kendall from the Morrison Center said, it might take me a decade to implement these six steps. And the point is not that I can just implement them tomorrow, it's that I'm gonna work and my organization is gonna work continuously to factor them into everything we do. And that's the real work, right? The ongoing. So with that, that's the brief history.
Thank you, John Michael. And Lita, you know, John, you brought up the steps, and I'm going to share in the chat, and then I'm just going to read through really quickly what these are. I pulled it off Radio Boise's website. They have seven, so they may have added one themselves. And the reason I chose them is we just heard the other day in the coalition meeting that Radio Boise has a, you know, the leader of their board said, you know, we need to expand representation on our board, and she found six new board members, all of whom are people of color. John Michael said the word BIPOC, that means Black, Indigenous, and people of color. I'll try to bring folks along with some of the language I think that has is sort of helping guide this group. But really quickly, and number one, include members of the Black community in the creation of programming and content, right? Radio Boise just did a great job of making sure they're in that space. Number two, support the Black community with access to and resources for independent projects or programs. Prioritize intentional recruitment and hiring practices of Black staff, leadership, and board members. by investing time and or resources to expand recruitment outside of existing networks. Create anti-racist policies within governing and management documents at board and staff levels. Articulate the necessity of cultivating a deeper understanding of the communities that we serve and incorporate their perspectives, needs, feedback, and priorities. Provide time and resources on an annual basis for board staff to attend ongoing professional Black-led anti-racism training and commit to the ongoing practice of anti-racism as individuals and organizations by fostering a culture of accessibility and receptivity to learning. But as John Michael said, and Lee, I'm hoping you can take it from here, but coming up with a statement may have seemed like the hard part at the time, but obviously the real work is starting.
I'll add one thing, Greg. Just there was an intentional effort by the working group that put the statement together to also focus on Black versus BIPOC. And that was a big conversation we had as a greater community. Many of the listeners might be aware of the 1619 Project by the New York Times. A lot of the root and system of racism in our nation definitely affects Indigenous people of all color. But we focused on Black because we know that when you focus on uplifting the least among us, the people that have been disenfranchised, you bring along everyone. And so there was a concerted effort to say Black versus BIPOC with this statement and with these action steps. And that's still a point of discussion and contention at times, but it was a decision we made collectively. So I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you, John Michael. Yeah, that's, you know, to me, it kind of reminds me of the debate that goes along with when people say Black Lives Matter. You know, that never means only Black Lives Matter. That's not ever what that means. It just means these are the lives that are being treated like they don't matter right now. And so we need to say that they do. You know, so the focus on Black people in this anti-racism coalition certainly was not only Black people, but just knowing that historically in our society, we have seen that if we have sweeping diversity statements, that those diversity efforts can be met with still without ever including Black people. And that often happens, you know, that there'll be other people of color that will be included in the process. And so then the diversity needs will be met. And then you'll look and you'll say, you still only have one Black person in your entire organization. You know, so by naming Black people specifically and getting to the very specific historical racist problems that we're trying to address, that other people of color are also going to be benefited and amplified and lifted and included in that process as well. It's not supposed to be exclusionary. It's just supposed to be making sure that no one's left out. So one of the things that I was asked to provide to all of you lovely listeners today was there's a form that I brought to our last meeting that really highlighted the reality of what systemic racism actually looks like and how it shows up in arts and culture organizations so that people could really see, oh yeah, I definitely know some organizations that are like that, or oh geez, my organization is like that. And it's a continuum. So it's called, and this is gonna be provided to everybody, I think, in a link later, you can look it up, Continuum on Becoming a Fully Inclusive Arts and Culture Organization. And it's divided into three sections. The first section is racial and cultural differences are seen as deficits. The second section is where organizations are tolerant of racial and cultural differences. And the third section is racial and cultural differences are actually seen as assets. So on this continuum, we are striving to have racial and cultural differences be seen as assets. But it was very illuminating because when I read through this form at our meeting and people raised their hands when they identified certain philosophies or practices that described organizations they know, we have a lot of organizations in town that are still definitely within the category of seeing racial and cultural differences as deficits. Even if they wouldn't admit that or they don't think that's what they're doing, that is actually what they're doing. So here's an example of a couple of the descriptions. Programming is centered on white artists, Western European art forms, and white cultural values. Well, that actually describes a whole bunch, you know? And that was one of the most illuminating conversations that we've had, I think, is the the basic questioning of who is it that made the decisions about what is value? What is good art? What is good dance? What is good music? What is, you know, who created those standards, those ideals, those preferences? Because the reality is all of those things are all based on the people who are in charge of those particular organizations. And if you look up the racial makeup of that, it's predominantly white across the board. So it's been well-meaning white folks, you know, who have been creating the rules of what is it that we're trying to show? Who gets their art displayed on the walls? Whose music do we feature? What composers are seen as high quality composers? All of those decisions historically have been made by white folks using white preferences and white values. And so when we talk about dismantling systems, we mean really having to first just own that. Own that that's actually what's been happening. And then whether or not we're now perpetuating it, or willing to start breaking that down. So here's another one. The inclusion of people of color artists is perceived as lowering the quality of the art. Again, some of these things you might not hear people outwardly say, but that's what they mean. You know, it's seen as more like a charity or a one-off. You know, there's a bit of white savior in there. Like, look, we're going to showcase a whole month for these Black artists. But really underlying what's happening is like, because normally that art wouldn't have been included in the show, or normally that style of dance wouldn't have been seen as meeting the quality. So it's a tokenized.
That's so important, Lita, that the norm is this white preference, and a niche program is something exceptional and rare and happens a certain time, Black History Month. But not necessarily part of the programming. Yeah.
And the idea, the last one that I'll read from this is fear that the inclusion of art from people of color, art, dance, music, all of those, will result in a loss of support from donors. And the reality is that's true. Like John Michael already alluded to. I mean, we have had beloved benefactors in the community that people love and respect, who absolutely 100% said, if you are involved in this anti-racism coalition, I will pull all of the funding from this arts organization. You know, so people don't want to think that that's what's really going on, but that's what's really going on. We very much in this community have arts organizations that, and culture organizations and history organizations that are dependent on white benefactors, white money, white donors. And a lot of them are not interested and are not willing to continue supporting organizations that want to expand beyond that. And that's the ugly truth. Okay, let me read you a couple of the descriptions of, or for organizations who might be in that middle ground, which is tolerant of racial and cultural differences, not necessarily seeing them as an asset yet, but tolerant of. So everybody keep in mind, see if this seems like it rings a bell to an organization you're familiar with. Carries out intentional inclusiveness efforts like recruiting someone of color for a committee or a staff person. Again, these are kind of tokenized, right? Marketing materials in the website include a higher percentage of people of color than the actual organization has. So they present this picture. They know enough to know that they should be presenting as if they have diversity, even if it doesn't actually reflect the reality of the organization. The primary strategy for hiring is to just include a generic statement about encouraging people of color to apply. But then they can't understand why people of color don't respond to those efforts. And that's a big one, right? They just put it into a statement. So there isn't any real deep, meaningful relationship building happening. It's just tacked on to the casting description or the job description or the whatever else, saying, hey, we encourage everyone to apply, or people of color particularly should apply. And then people don't understand why. And then they, a lot of times what happens is they can wash their hands and say, well, we tried, we offered, and nobody applied, without recognizing like why though, what is happening in the lack of relationship building that's existing for why people don't know about you or feel connected to you or Those in decision-making positions may still be predominantly white, even if more of the artists and supporting staff include BIPOC. And that's one of the major, major points we talked about, is that when we're talking about diversity, it doesn't just mean bringing in artists, bringing in staff. It means who's actually making the decisions, who's on the board, who's in management, who are the ones who are making the lasting decisions that are shaping those organizations. And a lot of times that's where you'll really see pushback. You'll really see some of the resistance, you know, well, we have this Black person or that Black person or this person of color or that person of color, but the door's closed as far as who's actually being allowed to be making impactful decisions within the organization, you know. And people of color have experienced that on every level. I just spoke with a woman 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago who had 3 different meetings that week where the concepts of racism had been brought up. And every single one of those meetings, it had been shut down because people were worried that it would make the white people, honestly, it would make the white people uncomfortable. Like, well, we can't really talk about that. We shouldn't really talk about that. It's going to make people uncomfortable. You know, and she was kind of the one person in the room sitting there, you know, so she didn't have any decision-making power. She's there in the room, but she's not actually being given decision-making power. And so it's a tokenization, and that happens a lot. So for my final thing that I want to say about this continuum is I want to just list a couple what we're striving for. Like John Michael said, this is a process. This is, for some organizations, they're seeing quick turnaround. I have, hopefully I'll have time to tell you about some of the successes. Greg already talked about one of them with Radio Boise in what they've done with their board and their programming. There's some significant shifts that have happened. Boise Philharmonic had a wonderful conversation that Eric Garcia was talking about. Composers that he, you know, that had just never gotten the recognition they should. That just because there was just this habit of sticking with these kind of known and familiar people, and that's what people want to hear, and that's what they'll pay for, and that's what they keep doing year after year. And so he's been having, you know, a wonderful time uncovering these lesser known but brilliant composers of color that to start featuring. So there's been some wonderful changes very quickly, but a lot of this work is going to take time. But here's some things that we're aspiring to. An organization commits to the process of intentional institutional restructuring based on anti-racist analysis and identity. Restructuring can be scary, it can be painful, it takes work, it takes effort, it takes commitment. But that's what has to happen. In order for it to not be performative, there has to be restructuring. People of color are included in all levels of the organization, from board to staff. The organization commits to dismantling racism in the wider community and builds clear lines of accountability. And that is important because, as we might talk about, or somebody might ask questions about it, you know, some of the barriers for artists in the community happen before audition time ever comes. It's who's even having access to the kind of training that's required to get to the level where you are applying for schools or trying to be cast in something. And how can the arts organizations be meaningfully involved in the community on a level to where truly there's equity? All children are having the same access to these private instruction and all of these things. If y'all remember Chanel from Trey McIntyre Project, beloved Chanel, you know, she's doing this amazing program in New York now that many of our Boise people are connected to as donors. And she was talking about, you know, the barriers that the dancers of color will have in that community, because in order to actually be taken seriously, you need to have professional headshots in this resume, and you have to have attended this summer program and this and that and this and that. And so there are barriers on a lot of levels within our arts organization. Same thing, you know, if a grant thing is asking for portfolios and what is your history of this and that, and where else have you shown your artwork and this and that, like in what ways are we putting up barriers? So it's it being involved in anti-racism on the wider community is important. Finally, they reach out to involve people of color in those communities for all of their programming. Not just like, we're going to do this special thing to highlight Black people or Latina people or the, you know, Indigenous community, but all of the programming involving people of color in the community in the whole shebang and not tokenizing and not, we're going to focus on you for this month, but the whole time. So these are some of, finally, the last thing I'll say, and this is key to everything, and it'll tie us back into the conversation, acceptance of honest and direct feedback while holding compassion for each person. Honest and direct feedback, being willing to learn and being willing to receive feedback about how you're doing from the communities of color.
I'll ask a quick question to the listeners, the members right now. Lita said a moment ago, for a lot of, especially white-centered white folk, talking about racism makes you uncomfortable. Do a quick self-check. How many people are feeling uncomfortable right now? And I just want to encourage us as we have these conversations to lean into that discomfort and also with it, uncertainty. Like I'm sure some of you are asking, but if we don't program X and Y, if we don't just do Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, what does that mean? Are we doing classical music? Are people going to fund it? And this sort of a quick catchphrase that I use, but uncertainty precedes creativity. Like until you have a level of uncertainty about what's going to come, you're not going to create a new paradigm. And doubt precedes courage. So if you're also feeling uncomfortable and having doubt right now that you think this could work or can we actually change, you're not going to be courageous enough to make that change until you also have that doubt. So I want to sanction us. I want to give us all permission to be uncomfortable and have doubt right now. And then I have it in front of me exactly. I'll imperfectly quote Angela Davis, who said, you have to believe that radical change is possible and you have to work for it every day. Something along those lines, right? That we actually can have an anti-racist society. But in order to do it, there are concrete steps like Lita just illuminated that are so essential that we have to take. But it also requires daily doses of courage and creativity, which require uncertainty and doubt.
Awesome. I do want to take a sec because we're about halfway through to remind the radio audience on Boise State Public Radio. This is a City Club of Boise virtual conversation. We're having a panel discussion about the work that arts, culture, and history organizations in Idaho are doing to confront a legacy of racism, both in the state and in their actual, in the arts and history sectors, where it is very real and has been for a long time, with John Michael Schert and Lita Harris Neustadter. Thank you both again for doing this. And I want to dive back in maybe on a little bit more to what you both just brought up right there at the end. This, you know, John Michael said something a few years back that I steal all the time about when it comes to marketing or thinking about an organization, you got to name it and claim it, right? That is, I don't know if you created that, but I credit you all the time with that. That's true in this case. Obviously, it's a wildly different scenario, but just naming the system and having the courage to talk about it is really important. And I think a lot of people think before they get to this point, maybe we shouldn't talk about race, and that's part of the way to solve this problem.
You know, it reminds me of a post actually I just saw today. A friend of mine who's very involved in the church, he's a pastor at one of the churches in Nampa. And he's also a musician. He leads the music worship there. He's a brilliant, beautiful, beautiful singer. And he was asking, you know, why is the church so reluctant to talk about race? You know, this has been an ongoing thing for him. And my response to that is the same thing that I was thinking. You know, the thing is it, you know, people avoid shame and guilt. Right? I don't personally know anybody who enjoys feeling shame and or guilt. And if it's possible to avoid feeling shame and or guilt, we will, you know. It's kind of human nature to not want to feel bad about something. But the reality is, in order to accept that as white folks, you've been complicit in upholding white supremacist systems, not because you're a bad person, but just because we all live in a society and all of us, unless we're actively fighting against it, are perpetuating it. There are plenty of people of color who are also perpetuating systems of white supremacy because they don't know better. They don't know, you know. So recognizing, like, I've been a part of something that has been harmful to people, that doesn't feel good, right? Because we all want to think we're good people and that we're doing the right thing and we're caring and we're kind. And having to face, like, some of the things I've been doing have been harmful to other people, it hurts our ego. It's not who we think we are. And so people will avoid it. And to me, it's like one of the most important things that people need to do is, for one thing, stop seeing everything in so binary. Like, you can still be a good person, but also have perpetuated harmful systems or been a part of something that was harmful. Like, it doesn't mean you're not like inherently a good person. It just means you are involved in stuff that's harmful. And now you have a choice about whether or not to learn about that, wake up, make changes, do better. You know, but as long as we are stuck in this place of like, but I'm a good person, you know, this kind of a defensive unwillingness to see the reality that has flaws and blemishes, then we're stuck. We can't move forward.
I think that's the crux of it. I think there's no broken systems. Systems are optimized to do what they do. And I think the status quo is very powerful. And part of being in a system that favors one group of people over another is that everything is optimized in that way through generations. And a lot of it was, you know, concretely done at times. And sometimes it's just been passively upheld by future other generations. But the status quo will fight back when you try to change it, or when you try to tell the status quo that it's not working. It will often go on the defensive. And so I think what Lita's pointing out is really essential, because to acknowledge, to first diagnose that we're all part of the problem can be very hard. You know, the American story up until just recently has been that every generation is wealthier than the last and more educated and getting better, and everything's getting better and better. So it goes a little bit against also some of our Americanism to be like, actually, it's not been great for a lot of people for a long time. And it's not getting better until we talk about it. And that can be very upsetting, I think, to a lot of Americans who are like, no, the moral arc of the universe is bending towards justice. Everything's working. It's like, well, it only works because it's only going to work if we actually bring it up and we actually diagnose these issues.
Right. And then it's okay to do so. Right. I mean,
it's necessary. I would say, you know, it's necessary to do so, you know?
Yeah, I'll just bring up a small example, because we're listening to a City Club event, and traditionally City Club events are moderated by a set group of people who have either been on the board or the forums committee, and over 25 years now, that's been the rule. Well, early into this last year, when we were thinking about how are we going to have a conversation about where gender and racism meet, we didn't have that expertise on the board. And so we asked Professor Sanders from the University of Idaho to be that moderator. And even just yesterday, we still haven't gone through it. And I'm part of that process of thinking, okay, but isn't it, don't we have a reason for this? It's because people are experts. And then it's like, well, wait a second. Midway through the sentence, you realize, well, who decides who's an expert on what, and how do you shape that? And it's a conversation that we're gonna continue to have. And it's not, you know, this stuff has been embedded in who the organization is. An organization that I fully believe in and think is the heart's in the right place and has always, you know, has strived to kind of be in the right spot can find itself in one of these areas where, just as you said, Lita, I think unknowingly people have maybe set up a system that ends up being pretty exclusive.
Yeah, and it's harmful, and, you know, it's based in an ignorance that we all have to take ownership in. I mean, just the other day, I was thinking about a particular style of dance that I remember watching. And I remember thinking, they're not really doing anything. They're just like, you know, it seemed to me like, well, that's not nearly as complicated. It doesn't take as much training as this other kind of dance. And the reality is, all of that was because I didn't have a very deep understanding about what this cultural dance is that I was watching. And once I actually learned, you know, years later, when I learned more about the meaning of the foot movements they were doing and what it was, you know, suddenly I realized this is a rich, vibrant performance I'm watching right now. And the value system that I had used years prior to kind of dismiss it as not being nearly as challenging, not being as, you know, I wouldn't pay as much to watch that as I would to watch this other thing. You know, it was just me having internalized, again, these kind of white preferences of art and where value is and what makes good art. And, you know, it's like, it can those values can have seeped into us in ways that we don't even realize that we're perpetuating. And education is the thing, you know, education and expansion and awareness is what really opens that up. It starts to peel the layers of that onion back. So we start to see, oh, wow. Yeah. You know, a lot of the judgments I was making were based on these preferences and ideals and values that I didn't even realize I had absorbed just because that's the society we live in.
Well, conformity is not love, right? And for a long time, like speaking on dance and like my background as a ballet dancer, I started my career with a large ballet company. And my best friend, roommate for years and years was Misty Copeland. And she's made a big mark now as a black ballerina. But she's really brought to the fore, like, who got to decide what the ideal shape of the body was in order to excel? Well, go back far enough, it was a white culture in France and Russia. And ballet dance is just the most eloquent form of body language, really. Like, it's just gestures, and those gestures all have meaning. And what you were just saying, Anita, every culture has gestures that mean something, and they have deep meaning. Ballet was the commodification of Western royal gestures, societal court, you know, intrigue and norms. So when people now say, oh, I just prefer classical ballet, what you're saying is, like, I prefer those sort of like Western white royal aristocratic ways of seeing and organizing the world. Every culture has, like, Basque dancing is so rich. With Trey McIntyre Project years ago, we were commissioned by Hialdi for the 2010 festival to make a piece about Boise Basque culture. Maybe some of you here saw that. And we got a fantastic year of training in Basque dancing and Basque culture. And then you really learn, as you were just saying, Lita, like, why this movement is this way. Don't just do the movement. Like, it has meaning. Societal dancing. Victor Hugo said, the Basque people are the only people who he know that define themselves by how they sing and dance, right? So I don't agree with that. I think there's many cultures that define themselves that way. He meant, like, the only white European culture that defines itself that way. So right. I think there's so... Yeah, there's so much more information that we've discounted, and we've expected people to conform to one ideal. And that's a reckoning that's happening in the ballet world. Now, just to bring it back to the coalition, that's also the beauty of this organization that's been created, is we're not just accountable to each other in this geographic area of Boise and the Treasure Valley. We're accountable to our peers nationwide and worldwide. So there's huge trends happening, as Lito was just pointing out with Eric Garcia at the Phil. But that's happening in orchestras now everywhere. And the Phil is doing a fantastic job of being a part of that movement. The theater companies nationwide, a group was started called Dear White Theater. And it was, you know, looking at, we see you, we see all the actions you've taken, and we're going to hold you accountable. The same thing's happening in the dance world. So part of this coalition is also that we're not doing this in isolation, that we're doing it with our compatriots, our colleagues, our collaborators nationwide, worldwide, and with each other locally. Now, how do we build a collective action movement is the next big question for this coalition. How do we maintain momentum? And how do we also not fall prey to the same sorts of, like, white imperialistic systems that we all are a part of? Like, what is a board of directors? What is a hierarchy system? And Greg, I know you valiantly jumped into a working group where we were trying to craft that for the coalition. Like, you know, how do we organize ourselves? Is it a membership dues structure? And I'll just say to the listeners right now, we don't know yet, because what happened was, as this working group started to go down that path with the best of intentions, we realized that we were falling prey to the same patterns. We were setting up hierarchy systems that weren't really what we wanted. We were moving away from being Black led in some instances, you know, so we are a living, breathing entity, this coalition, that's a collective action. It's only as good as each member continuing to do the work within their own organizations. But the question is, how do we keep coming together to build a collective action that's stronger, larger than the sum of the parts? And I know there's some questions coming in to the Q&A.
So I want to add, before we get to those questions, I want to add one thing to what John Michael just said. You know, one of the things that we know is the way to still perpetuate white supremacy is to have the forward movement based on consensus. The way to move toward liberation is to have that forward movement based on alignment of values. So what I mean is, the key is knowing the anti-racist values and goals and moving forward with that, knowing that some people are not going to like it. Some people are going to feel uncomfortable with it. Some people aren't going to like the wording. Some people are going to, whatever. But if the goal is to try to soften the wording and rephrase this and do that so that we get everybody on board, which is a focus on consensus, then we will not be moving forward. So we know the how of moving forward. We know that it has to be focused on the values of liberation and not consensus building.
Well, you know, I'll jump into a couple of questions really quickly because they're sort of tied in with what you're talking about. And Lita, you did bring up a couple of examples, and maybe you have some more. Someone asks, you know, are there any, what's the practical first step or two, right? How do we begin this process? And, you know, and this is an organizational leader or a member, at least, and could be a City Club member, hoping that we make some additional movement here.
You know, I don't think that the one answer applies, right? Because everybody comes in at different stages, which is fantastic. Some people have already actually been having conversations like this for a while. Some organizations are large with a big spectrum of values that they have with. Some people are small. They just got four people involved and it's not, you know, so people are going to be coming from different places. I just talked to somebody from the Fair Housing that I'm going to be doing some training with later. And what I suggested to her was I gave her an assessment. There's like basically like a racial equity assessment that organizations can do within their staff, within their organizations. And it's, you know, kind of an intensive questions and this and that, but it's a way for them to figure out where are we? Because you got to kind of figure out that. I mean, you got to figure out where are you now, and then that'll help you know where to move forward. One other thing I'll say to that is I'm on the community advisory board for Boise Public Radio, and we had a wonderful conversation in one of our committees where we were talking about wording of kind of the statement around diversity and whether the CAB, how the CAB feels about, you know, what kind of a priority is diversity within the CAB. And it became clear to me that there was not shared language. People weren't on the same wavelength about what different terms meant, you know? And so to me, it was like, well, we definitely need to stop moving forward with trying to figure out this wording. And we need to bring in, we need to bring outside in, somebody from the outside in to do training, to talk to us about anti-racism and diversity and inclusion, equity, so that we can all get a little bit more on the same page and at least make sure we're using the same terminology. Like, we're not ready to be forming statements yet. Like, we just need some basic education as a group, you know, so that's what we're going to do. So people are going to be in different stages. Is that a good way to not answer that question?
No, I think that's really important.
I think that's exactly it. And do it, right? That's what, you know, again, I bring up the Radio Boise thing. I've heard this for years when at Boise State, right? It's like, you know, how do we increase the diversity of faculty? How do you increase the diversity of staff? And someone in the room always wisely says, hire more people with diverse backgrounds. It's the doing that matters, right? It's the taking those steps. John Michael, you wanted to add something. I have another question for you right after that.
To that point, Greg, it falls into maybe you have to reevaluate your criteria for how you hire those people. I was at University of Chicago Booth School of Business, this like paragon of free market capitalism, and they had the same issue. Like, they had one woman of color on their faculty, right? And they were having a problem recruiting female MBAs. Well, look at your roster of faculty. Would you want to go to a school that has so few women on faculty? So, but they had to revisit their entire criteria, and they pride themselves on the Chicago way, right? Like this very astute Socratic method. Well, it had racism built in. So that's so it's before you go and just hire people, you got to also go back and revisit. But Lita, I think it was a good answer you just gave. The first step is diagnosing, and 80% of failures are failures of diagnosis. Like, you didn't actually spend the time looking, asking questions, doing the difficult work. So that document that I believe everyone who signed up for the session got sent, and maybe City Club can put it on their website for radio listeners that Lita was highlighting earlier. The first step is have a frank conversation with your board, your staff, your organization, and say, where are we? Where are we? Which category are we in? Without shame or guilt, but shame or guilt is part, you know, might happen, might flow from it as a symptom, but name where you are, and then you can begin to craft the next steps. But we often skip over that first diagnostic session. Greg, and, sorry, you said you had. Go ahead, Lita.
Yeah, I just want to throw in, because it's actually something that's on the continuum that is a problem that you were both just speaking to as well, which is, you know, along the continuum is people of color who do end up at the organization then have to face microaggressions and an unhealthy work environment. And that speaks to the idea of retention, right? A lot of times organizations will focus on recruitment, but not retention. So they're just focusing on trying to get the people of color in, but they're not focusing on, is this actually an environment where people of color, BIPOC, Indigenous, Black, you know, is this actually an environment where people are empowered, where they are heard, where they are, you know, welcomed, where they are, where there's true equity within this organization? Because otherwise they're going to come, then they're going to go, which is what keeps happening at Boise State. You know, they keep having these Black faculty, you know, or somebody comes in to be the diversity person and, you know, they get harassed and they leave because there's no, the inherent problems within the system aren't being addressed.
Yeah. And with the, and I can tell you with 8 years of Boise State, the absolute best intentions across every aspect of that place. Right. And there's, you know, one thing I learned there that even in addition to the equity piece, I think is if you're asked to be the only Black faculty member in the College of Business, of any College of Business, we're not just asking you to be a teacher in the classroom and a researcher, but the de facto unpaid counselor and advisor of every Black student in that college, right? That's not an additional ask that happens. You know, I don't get a whole slate of all the young white men who immediately find somebody that they can connect with. And, you know, that's the ask, right? It's an additional ask on someone. It's an additional ask to say, you're a great artist and you're a great performer and we need you on our board. And this is the tokenization, right? This is where the tokenization thing.
Which is, you know. Because,
but you also represent all Black people and not just them, all Latinx people and everyone else in the world.
Exactly, also, which is, you know, to me, why you have to really question then intentions, right? You know, is that really the best of intentions? You know, when the intention is to bring somebody into an environment that is not going to be supportive, actually kind of tokenize them because you're going to expect them to be the go-to for all the things now, you know, and you're going to expect that person to thrive in this atmosphere of isolation. You know, whose intentions, who was it that you were trying to serve in that? You know, that was you checking off a box. That wasn't you actually thinking you were doing that person of color any favors or offering them actually this grand opportunity, you know? So, and that's to me, you know, like the crux of it. It's like reexamining that. What are our actual intentions and taking a hard, honest look at like, who are we actually really trying to serve here? And I guarantee you 9 times out of 10, the honest answer is going to be we're being self-serving right now. We are being self-serving. And until we start truly focusing on the needs of the Black people, the Indigenous people, the people of color, and what they actually need, then we're not actually making systemic changes.
We also know that conformity happens. Like we saw this with the integration of women into boards and management. One woman doesn't change anything because they're so overwhelmed by the norms of the society. They end up conforming or capitulating. It's the same thing with diversity in terms of race, in terms of LGBTQ, in terms of all kinds of forms. Tokenism, exceptionalism don't change. There actually has to be enough of a critical mass. Why? It's the same with programming. Don't just do like Black History Month programming. Like that treats it as other. And it continues to say the norm is the norm. This is the exception. And there was a question in the chat. Darwin Roy asked, you know, is there such thing as like a post-racist society? Well, race was only a concept when there was the other. Like there only is white because there is Black in our nation. Up until the ending of slavery, it was more about division between like Italians and Germans. And you know, the idea of a white culture didn't even happen until there was the other. So the idea of a post-racist society, I don't know if we move away from race. It's acknowledging, as we've been saying, that all these races exist and the history and the information, like in this type of dance versus ballet, has just as much equal weight, value, information to share. And so that they all are uplifted. And I don't know if that's post-racist. I think it's actual multiculturalism, multi-racism in a true manner.
I want to share this Great. Quote because I just saw it like 5 minutes before this started. It was from an old, like 60s interview or something, but it's brilliant. Racism was created to justify the slave trade, to justify the colonial system, and to justify the utter ruthlessness that had to go into the making of modern capitalism, right? This is so deeply systemic. Like our whole capitalistic society, it's embedded in all of that. It's complicated.
I'll add that, you add to it now philanthropy, which is also an offshoot of capitalism, which the arts and culture world lives on, which I think philanthropy is beautiful. And I think generosity of philanthropists is beautiful. But we have to also begin to acknowledge and evaluate the roots of that. Why is there this sort of, you know, caste system of those with wealth that support those without? And that's a whole maybe other conversation, but I think it's very tied to, in becoming an anti-racist arts and culture world, we have to really look at labor and artist output and what is that worth, and especially artists of color that have had their work, you know, stolen and appropriated. Like what we think of as American rock and roll was Black R&B, right? So the Rolling Stones didn't come up with those songs, people. So when we really begin to look at equity of art, and we've talked about the state, Greg, you read the action steps that are part of the coalition, but there was also a statement that precedes it that was very explicit about that. The work of Black artists has been appropriated through time immemorial. If you look at pop culture and the charts, most of it is music that has its roots in Black culture. With the Super Bowl this past weekend, there's a fantastic Throughline podcast that did a whole breakdown of Whitney Houston's 1991 Star Spangled Banner at the Tampa World Series, and breaking that down, that it was even just remarkable that a Black woman was being upheld as a patriot at that moment of the Gulf War. I mean, we just have to look at so much. And so I know we're coming into time to kind of bring it together. We can't do this in isolation. We live in community and we are interdependent. And even though we talk about the arts and culture sort of sector, that's not a sector that actually spends that much time together. We don't come together all that often. And so the reason to be for the Arts and Culture and History Anti-Racism Coalition is to continue having community, to hold each other accountable, and to say, what are the bold, courageous, and potentially perilous steps that if we take it all together, it also mitigates, to a degree, risk. But it makes a statement and says, we're going to do this. And I want to applaud all the signatories, the organizations, the individuals that have done this work. And there's many that haven't been able to yet. Many that tried and got shut down by their boards. That's where we also need to refocus our efforts to begin to continue having those difficult conversations. And I know a lot of you on this webinar and folks that are going to be listening on the radio are asking, what can I do?
I was going to say, can we get just a little look ahead, and then you guys can all see why this has been a year long conversation of 2 hour meetings every month, and more so because it's such a deep, complicated, and important issue. But yeah, if you both could just throw like how, you know, somebody finishes this, what's next? What can I do?
Well, one thing is the meetings that we have are open. John Michael mentioned the word signatory, so organizations and individuals, right? Also, this is also for individuals that sign on and commit to those action steps. That's a signatory. Fantastic. Great. But even if you're not a signatory, the monthly gatherings that we have are still open. So you can still come. You can be part of the conversation. You can be part of the education process. You can still be part of that. And we welcome you. And maybe John Michael's probably, I bet, going to throw out some link ideas or some ways that you can get plugged in.
Yeah, anyone can sign. And signing means you agree to the statement and the action steps. You can go to the Searles Place website. I believe it has the link there. You can go to the Radio Boise website. Any of the signatories that we've already mentioned will have that link up. That's the best way to tap in. We're still a decentralized, non-organized structural entity so far, but it's a democratic body. So as Lita said, that's the best way to immediately tap in. The second thing is reach out also through that form and ask if your organization needs assistance having these conversations. Part of the coalition's goal is also to give resources. Lita and I have come and done sessions for Sorrel's Place Board, for Radio Boise Board, the Morrison Center Board. And so there's advanced ongoing trainings as well. But most importantly, the biggest takeaway I hope everyone has is find the doubt inside of yourself that leads to the courage to have the conversations that you need to have and ask difficult questions to diagnose, honestly.
And where, if you're a customer as well, right? You can ask places that you go to as patrons. Why are we not seeing music or programs or artwork by more artists of color, but, you know, it doesn't have to, even if you're not an employee of these organizations, my point is just saying, like, the entire community is part of this. You can still ask questions. You can ask, hey, has your board signed on to this? I heard about this anti-racism thing. Are y'all a part of this?
Yeah. Yep. Perfect.
I really appreciate the time, John, Michael, and Lita, like I do all the time with you two. And I'm sure that a lot of people learned a lot and have many more questions, but that's the thing. It's a process. Thank you all. You've been listening to virtual forum by the City Club of Boise on Boise State Public Radio. And thank you all for being here who are here, and thank you all for listening down the road.